The Times reports the story.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up, we're going to hear Florida this week, and then later on in the show, we're going to open up the phone lines and talk about some of the big news stories from the past few days. Hey, thanks to you. If you made your contribution to WMNF last week during the fund drive, we raised more than $202,000. We're hoping to get that to that $220,000 mark. If you haven't yet made a contribution to WMNF, we hope that you will. This is the way we stay on the air. You can go to WMNF.org and make a contribution right now. Help us close that gap that is, or was, 18,000, probably a lot better than that. A lot of people have been making contributions in the last few days after the marathon. So again, if you love WMNF, we hope you make a contribution right now at WMNF.org, our secure website. Coming up, Florida This Week. Coming up next, one more Democrat gets in the governor's race, while another says he will not run. The ongoing emergency in Puerto Rico emerges as a major issue in the U.S. Senate race. For some seeking help from Tallahassee, it pays to hire the speaker's brother. And what will President Trump's tariffs do to Florida businesses? Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
WEDU Studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Loride.
Welcome back. This week, our panelists are Bill Bunting is a Pasco County State Republican committeeman. Michael Van Sickler is the editor for government and politics at the Tampa Bay Times. Amy Hollifield is the deputy managing editor for politics, metro, and business at the Tampa Bay Times. And Jason Holloway is a legislative assistant and a Democrat. Well, it's wonderful to have you here. Billionaire Palm Beach real estate investor Jeff Green has officially entered the crowded Democratic primary for Florida governor. With his money, Green could shake up the race. The billionaire made his fortune from credit default swaps during the housing crisis. He had previously run and lost in the 2010 race for the U.S. Senate nomination. Green told the Palm Beach Post in April that he was underwhelmed by the current Democratic field of Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, former U.S. Congresswoman Gwen Graham, Winter Park businessman Chris King, and former Miami Beach Mayor Phil Levine. And this week, another Democrat who was considering a run for governor said no. Former Congressman Patrick Murphy decided against running and instead endorsed the only woman in the race, Gwen Graham. Murphy had considered running with former Pinellas Republican Congressman David Jolly on a bipartisan ticket. So, Jason, Green has money, but does he have any chance of winning the nomination?
For Jeff Green, I think it's too little, too late. I spoke with some friends that know Joe Trippi, who worked on his last campaign. He ended up spending just about $30 million. It wasn't enough money. There wasn't enough time. Rick Scott, for contrast, who ran for governor, spent $76 million. I just really think that we've only got 81 days left until the election. And we've only got 42 days left until the first ballots go out. And I just don't think there's enough time for him to make anything work. You know, he hasn't even spent a dollar, and he's been doing this for a week now.
So, Amy, he said he was unimpressed with the existing field, but you got to have a constituency, or you got to have a movement, or you got to have a policy that people love if you're going to jump in. I don't think you can just spend money and try to get your popularity up, can you?
I mean, I think it depends. We don't know. Because he hasn't done anything. He hasn't spoken to anyone. We don't really have a sense of what he's going to do. Is he going to drop $20 million, $50 million? who knows? I mean, that can definitely change things. We all know that this has been a primary that's been, you know, a little wishy-washy. Nobody's broken out. So there's a chance for things to change. Just it's very, very, very unclear what his plans are.
You don't think it's really Levine and Graham at this point?
You can make that case,
yeah.
Right? But as long as they've been going at this, it hasn't settled very much.
Mm-hmm.
And Levine is getting some traction now. There was a new poll today that put him out a little farther ahead than he has been. He's been sort of close.
Mm-hmm.
But still,
plus, he's got a track record. I mean, Green has not served in public office,
correct.
So we don't know where he stands.
Correct. There's a lot to learn.
Yeah. So, Bill, having a crowded Democratic primary is good for the Republicans.
Well, it's also good for the Tampa Bay Media Department because they're the ones that are going to reap the revenue, and they're going to do pretty well. I don't know. And it makes the Democrats spend a lot of money, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
We want to see that.
They're beating each other up in the primary?
I don't know how much they're going to beat up. I've got to agree with Amy. I think the top two front runners are going to be Gwen and Levine.
Yeah.
His commercials are pretty decent. And if her father comes out and gets behind her, I think she'll get traction in South Florida, which he hasn't done yet. And I think that may be why she's not up in the polls.
I think he could actually hurt Levine in this race because he's from South Florida. And
exactly.
There could be a draft effect for Glenn Graham here.
Exactly.
With him getting into the race.
Do you think that Bob Graham's time in politics, though, was so long ago that many current voters don't remember him?
I don't think so at all.
Yeah. Okay. You think that he certainly has pull?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, he's a revered statesman from our state who's mm-hmm. done a lot, has a lot of experience, can speak authoritatively on a bunch of issues. And when you see him get into the game here, he might make a difference.
All right.
And he never went off the wire like Chuck Schumer.
So, Michael, the other big news in the Democratic side this week was that Patrick Murphy decided not to get in as a candidate who headed a bipartisan ticket with David Jolly. What do you make of that?
Well, as Jason pointed out, it is getting late, and it's really hard at this point of the campaign because a lot of the smart money has already been committed, and if you're getting in this late, I think it's just a matter of... why would you jump out and run if you know that the money's not there? And I think, from what I've heard, they were working it pretty hard the last month, trying to figure out if they had the commitments. And not saying that they didn't, but it's going to be a tough slog with that amount of time left.
So is that a sign that the race, though, is gelling pretty quickly, that there's no opening for a new candidate?
Yeah, I mean, on both sides, it's starting to gel a little bit more quickly on the Republican side. But with the Democrats, I'm really interested in getting better polling data because the Levine poll is just for South Florida. We don't have really good statewide polling.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on the front of raising money, I think that is all getting locked down now.
Yeah.
And if you don't have it, don't run.
Bill, would you agree that the Republican race is pretty much gelling? Is it Adam Putnam's now?
You never take anything for granted, but I think Adam is outworking everybody. He's every place, everywhere, and we're looking forward for
it. But I still, you know, I'm still wondering about Ron DeSantis and all his appearances, especially on Fox News. And how important is that to the Republican primary voters?
It's important to the Trump voters. That's who it's important to, but not really to the primary voters. Primary voters are going to pay attention to the pocketbook, to the issues, and what they believe he should do in government.
It is a small segment of the population that votes in the primary. I mean, just a tiny percentage of each party votes.
It's about 20%, I think.
It's very small.
It's very small. Yeah. So, you know, you don't need much, really, to win that primary. And I'm wondering, does anybody think that Ron DeSantis' appearances on Fox News may pull a surprise out in the Republican primary?
I think it's entirely possible. I think there's been some bumps in the road for Adam Putnam, and I think you could say the expectation, given his pedigree, given his experience, that he and the money he's raised so much money that you would think that would be easy, but I don't know. I personally think it's utterly possible.
I was at the Hillsboro REC dinner a month or so ago, and both Adam spoke and DeSantis spoke. And I know two women personally from the Pasco REC that were there that were looking for DeSantis. They liked him. After listening to him and listening to Adam, they both came out and says, that's it, Adam's our guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's going to make a difference, too, when you're in front of the cameras and you have to speak the truth.
And that's the other thing, too, is that Putnam, I think, is everywhere in Florida campaigning. DeSantis's campaign really, for the most part, is on TV, right?
You kind of wonder when they're going to care that DeSantis isn't talking about state issues, the fact that he hasn't even engaged on it. I don't know how you feel, Bill, that that's been among Republican voters, but it's outrageous to me that we've got a man running to be governor of the state and we don't even know what
questions.
He wants to do.
Yeah. Jason, one last question. In the next couple of days, there's going to be two Democratic debates. Do you think the candidates at this point in the race are really going to start hammering each other? Is that?
Well, I think there are two things. I think, one, I think they have to. Two, I hope that they will have started to read more than just the New York Times. Maybe some local publications, maybe the Tampa Bay Times, maybe Sunburn. I hope they know how the state budget works this time. So I really just hope at the end of the day, and by the way, Jeff Green declined to go to the first debate. I just really hope they get those basics down and it's not an embarrassing debate.
Yeah, saying the New York Times is one of their prime sources of information was not a good thing. All right. Well, Governor Rick Scott and Senator Bill Nelson are criticizing each other over conditions in Puerto Rico and what's shaping up to be a major issue in this year's race for U.S. Senate.
Nelson joined Democrats who continued to denounce Scott for comments the GOP governor made last week when he said he would not have done anything differently from the Trump administration in response to Hurricane Maria. The death toll in Puerto Rico is far higher than previously thought. Many homes have not been repaired. Some roads are still impassable. And drinking water and electricity have not been restored to all parts of the island. Scott took a shot at the U.S. senator, saying that Nelson has accomplished little while in the Senate, and even now he's done little for Puerto Rico. The jabs, not to mention the numerous visits to Puerto Rico each has made since Maria struck in September, suggest the political importance that both candidates place on the U.S. territory. Scott's visit to Puerto Rico last week was his sixth since the hurricane. The storm and its aftermath had prompted a migration of tens of thousands of families from Puerto Rico to the U.S. mainland, many of them landing in Florida, where relatives and friends populate the important I-4 corridor from Tampa to Daytona Beach.
Bill, let me start with the recovery in Puerto Rico. Would it be fair to say that the recovery has been really slow to the hurricane?
You're right, and it's been extremely slow. But let's take it where the fault lies. The fault lies for Puerto Rico. They're in the Caribbean. They're in a hurricane-prone zone. They haven't had a major hurricane in 98 years, okay? Right after we had Andrew, that should have been their lesson to start shoring up your property, put your underground lines under from your power poles, take precautions, and safety should be an issue. And I'd like to see both of them criticize both governments in, whether you're a Democrat or Republican in Puerto Rico, because they never took any action. They were dependent on the United States. And I don't think the United States taxpayers should be flipping a bill for them.
All right, so they should have been better prepared. But now in the recovery phase, when you look at it, have we done enough as a country to help the folks get out of the predicament they're currently in?
I think that we did as much as we possibly can. How much money do you want to spend, do you want to keep sending in there? You've got to have some results from it. I haven't seen any results come there. And Nelson's been in the Senate 18 years. How many trips has he been to Puerto Rico before now? I haven't seen him in there at all. I mean, their concern is to get the vote out in Osceola and Orange County. I think on that Scott's got the edge because he speaks fluent Spanish.
Okay.
And I think that's going to help him.
Jason, what would you say about this? I mean, you know, to the question of have we done enough as a country to help the people of Puerto Rico recover, what would you say?
I don't think we've done enough. Senator Nelson and Governor Rick Scott, it's not their job to represent Puerto Rico in D.C. I think the real solution to this is they need somebody in D.C. advocating for them. It's not somebody in Florida. Why don't we make them a state? Why don't we give them a congressman? Why don't we give them a senator to have somebody in Congress to advocate for them? It's just not our job. I do think the federal government does need to do more, but I think why don't we empower them?
And I know Governor Scott has suggested that Puerto Rico should be allowed to become the 51st state. I'm not sure of the record of Bill Nelson. I don't know where he stands on that issue. Okay. So, Amy, the politics of this, I mean, a lot of people who have fled Puerto Rico are coming to Central Florida. They're registering their kids for school. Looks like they're going to be here for a while. But the question is, will they be voters? What's your sense of where that stands?
Our reporting shows that a lot of them won't be. I think there's been this expectation that tens of thousands of people are here and they're registering and they're going to make a difference in what have been historically super close elections in Florida. And the data is just not showing that, A, that there's that many people that have come, but B, we just had the former governor of Puerto Rico here endorsing Bill Nelson, and he talked about the really high participation rate in Puerto Rico for voting up in the 80s, but talk to what we've seen, which is not a very high participation rate when they get to the mainland, that historically hasn't been a certainty. And so the idea that this has become such a wedge issue in the Senate race is kind of silly when it's not as defined of an electorate as they're making it out to be.
All right, so Michael, why do these two politicians, though, why are Nelson and Scott trading jabs over the recovery? Why are they pointing fingers at you? What's at stake?
Well, I do believe there's a lot of optics at stake. I mean, you have a growing, just take away the people who left Puerto Rico and resettled. You still take that away and you still have a growing Hispanic population.
And many of them are Puerto Rican. Who came here before the hurricane.
Come from Puerto Rico, but not because of Maria. And it just plays well. Yeah. So both are trying to get that message across that they hear the misery that's happening right now in Puerto Rico.
So this may have a wider audience than just Puerto Rican voters. It could be all Latinos and our state and our federal response to the plight of Latinos.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at the demographic growth, I think that's the ultimate audience.
Bill, do you think with the endorsement of the governor of Puerto Rico the other day, how is Scott going to do?
I think you said the former governor.
Former governor, exactly.
It's a little different.
Exactly, yeah. current governor is conservative.
There is a Republican governor in Puerto Rico now, and I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
I don't know if that'll have much play. It depends on how popular he was. And like Amy says, how many are registered to vote here? In Puerto Rico, it may have an influence. I don't know if it's going to have any influence in the state of Florida.
All right. Jason?
So we do have the numbers on that. The New York Times did a piece that 50,000 Puerto Ricans ended up staying and about 7,000 registered to vote. So obviously those numbers are de minimis. But we do have more data on who, I forgot what I was going to say.
Yeah. Well, what you're citing is pretty much what the Times has been reporting,
right,
too. That is really low registration numbers for the Puerto Rican community. Okay. Well, by law, when someone is injured by the state or local government in Florida, the damages are limited to $200,000 unless you can get a claims bill passed in the state legislature.
In Tallahassee, it's notoriously hard to get a claims bill passed. In fact, in 2013 and 2014, not a single one was passed. But things turned around under House Speaker Richard Corcoran. That's when Florida lawmakers began clearing a backlog of payments to victims and families that were harmed by government action. The legislators' explanation for the dramatic shift was that it was their duty to abide by court rulings for the injured. Of the $37.5 million in claims bills approved over the past 2 years, nearly half was awarded to victims represented by a single lobbyist, the brother of Florida's House Speaker Richard Corcoran. The Associated Press reports that of the roughly 100 bills filed in the House and Senate during the 2017 and 2018 legislative sessions, 21 were approved, and 8 of those 21 were represented by Michael Corcoran's firm, Corcoran and Johnston. Altogether, the firm had a 42% success rate. Lobbying records show the Corcoran firm collected at least $89,000 in fees last year for its work on claims bills and is in line to receive tens of thousands more this year.
Amy, it seems like if you're injured by a state government or a local government, there's kind of a crapshoot whether or not, if that injury is maybe in the millions, it's a crapshoot whether or not you actually get paid.
Absolutely. It's kind of crazy. A judgment has been made in your favor that you're owed this money, and what you have to do to get that money is hire a high-paid lobbyist and go through a years-long fight in the hopes that you'll get that be one of the few that make it through the process.
In some years you get it, in some years there's
right.
no chance.
It's an utterly unfair system. It yeah. needs to be overhauled. It's the cap, I think, should be looked at. I think that 200,000, that it's been that way for a long time. It just doesn't seem fair. Mm-hmm. You start to think about lawsuits that we're going to get out of Parkland. And what, you know, that, think about it, those are going to be claims bills when you talk about suing government agencies. And it's just not right.
Michael, this has been going on for years. Have there been calls? I mean, I think one of the reasons they went through this year is that Corcoran says, if it's a question of people versus government, we're going to side with the people. And I understand that. But have there been calls for some sort of more structured system, a fairer system, a system that makes sense?
With the claims bills, it's always been a problem. But on the flip side, putting a cap just gets the right political support. On the cap side, you get Republicans like Bill over there, who you probably support tort reform. So you get that, and then you get the people who support cities and counties who don't want to go bankrupt with a class action suit. Mm-hmm. And so you get those two groups together, and it's got enough votes to pass.
Yeah, Bill, do you think the process needs to be reformed?
I don't know if it needs to be reformed. I think that it's a tough process. There's no question about it. But I think some of these lawsuits can wind up in federal court, and I think that'll make a difference on what mm-hmm. the cap can be.
Yeah,
because they put a standard on state courts. They don't put a standard on federal courts, and that's why I'm hoping Parkland goes forward and has federal lawsuits.
Yeah. So, okay, so if you hire the brother, the Speaker of the House, you're going to have a better chance of winning your, you know, the money for your claims bill.
Well, I think I don't want to, you know, question the motivations of Speaker Corcoran or anything like that. I think, though, there's the optics of the whole situation. I think it does kind of look bad. I do think that we need reform. We need, maybe you have an independent commission that looks at the claims bills and allows the legislature to pay people back. But just the way it looks now, regardless of what actually goes on, it just doesn't look good.
Okay. Well, the Florida Chamber of Commerce, a statewide business group closely aligned with Governor Rick Scott, warned this week that President Trump's new tariffs could spark a trade war and hurt Florida jobs and families.
President Trump has proposed across-the-board steel and aluminum tariffs on some of America's closest allies, including Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. The chamber disagrees with the president on this one and said unfair trade practices are best addressed in a targeted and a focused way. The tariffs could affect the price of many things here in Florida, from six packs of beer to building construction to air conditioners.
All right. So, Michael, the State Chamber of Commerce at odds with the president, who they otherwise back. What do you make of that?
Well, it puts Rick Scott in a tough spot. No group has probably been as adamantly behind Rick Scott as the chamber. This is the jobs governor, after all. He's invested a lot in ports. He's a supporter of global trade. And then he has a president who he supports impose these steel and aluminum tariffs, which really, according to the chamber and a lot of economists say, is really going to put a bind on a lot of Florida businesses. So on the one hand, he's got to, so far he hasn't criticized Trump, mm-hmm. but he's trying to show that there is concern, he recognizes it, and he wants to relay it to the White House. But it's going to be a tough issue for him to resolve.
So, Bill, pressure on the governor to break with the president on this issue?
I don't know if there'll be pressure on the governor, because in reality, what the president did with tariffs, I'm not opposed to, because I think it's going to be short-lived. I mean, you look at the Times newspaper, they were in trouble with their pension plan just recently. The money that's coming back in from the jobs that are being created nationally are putting money back in, the stock market's rolling where they have their money, and all the pension plans, both in New York State and California, are becoming healthy again. So I don't know if it's going to be an issue.
Jason, I'm wondering, though, you know, we have a pretty healthy beer industry here in the state of Florida, both national brands, and we've got the craft brands. They use aluminum cans. Construction uses steel. Air conditioning uses a lot of metal. Those are prime industries for the state of Florida.
Right, and the tariffs could definitely hurt us. You know, at the end of the day, we need to realize tariffs are a tax. I like what Republican Senator Orrin Hatch actually said, chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He said that Americans do not like taxes. Tariffs are taxes, and they don't want them. Yeah. And that's coming straight from him. I mean, it's true. It's going to hurt us, and it's not good.
Would you expect the governor to feel the pressure and be forced to say something? Or
I think eventually it's going to come to a head in the campaign as we move on.
It'll become an issue.
Right.
And somebody's going to question him and ask him whether or not he supports the terrorists.
Exactly.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Michael, let's start with you. Your other big story.
Back to Adam Putnam. We're reporting that his Department of Agriculture oversees the concealed weapon permit process. So if you want to apply for a concealed weapon permit, you go to his office. For about from February of 2016 to, what was it, March of 2017, their employees who do that couldn't get access to the FBI background check system. So they just approved the
Is that permits. A requirement that they get access? Is that a requirement?
It's a requirement for the process.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying to do is determine, they have access to the FDLE statewide criminal background check system, but they want to see if any of the applicants committed crimes or have issues in other states. And that's what the FBI database mm-hmm. does. And they just didn't have access to it because one of the employees lost the login. So they couldn't log in. And meanwhile,
But they allowed all these to go through.
Right.
All right. Jason, your other big story.
My big story has to do with transportation. Everybody wants better transportation, right? Well, this week, Hyperloop Technologies came to Tampa Bay. They met with all the MPOs, met with some senators and representatives, and we're working on this next year doing a feasibility study to bring a Hyperloop to Tampa Bay. Well, what is that? Think of a train, but about 1,000 times faster. So it will go 700 miles an hour. It'll take you from Tampa to St. Pete in 5 minutes. So obviously the technology is still in development, but we're looking at maybe in the next couple of years having some kind of alternative mode of transportation maybe we can all agree on. It's also much, much cheaper than light rail.
All right. All right. Amy, your other big story.
My other big story is Rays stadium talks. We've got a story in Sunday's paper about the deadline is actually coming up. The deal that the Rays had made with St. Petersburg over having 3 years to explore alternate sites for a stadium, it actually expires in January of next year. Seems hard to imagine that 3 years have gone by so quickly. But so now we're sort of staring at a deadline to come to an agreement over financing in Tampa over whether we're going to do a stadium at the site that the Rays have picked in Ybor City. And I think there's a lot of questions over whether that's possible, and then it becomes, well, what happens next? What happens in terms of negotiating with St. Petersburg?
All right. And Bill, you're on the big story.
Well, my big story tomorrow night, I says, well, anybody you talk about is going to be at my dinner. Governor Scott's going to be there. Adam Putnam's going to be there. Rich Corcoran's going to be there. Fellow workers, Majority Leader Simpson, senators from all over the state, and it's the largest fundraiser in the Tampa Bay area. For a small county, we'll beat both Pinellas and Hillsborough, and they have twice as many people. So that's a credit to the people in Pasco.
That's your Reagan Day dinner.
That's
all right.
Our Reagan Day dinner.
All right. Thank you all for a great show. Thanks for watching Florida This Week.
Well, that was Florida This Week, which is a TV show that airs Friday nights on WEDU, the PBS station in Tampa. And my guest on that show, Bill Bunting, was the Republican on that show. Jason Holloway was the Democrat. And two reporters from the Tampa Bay Times were there. Amy Holyfield and Michael Van Sickler were there. And if you want to comment about any of those topics, the race for governor, also the response to the Puerto Rican hurricane disaster or trade tariffs or claims bills in Tallahassee, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. You can also email us here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. There is going to be, we talked a little bit about the upcoming Democratic candidates debate that took place on Saturday night after we aired that show Friday night on WEDU-TV. And there's a good report about that debate this morning in the Tampa Bay Times. There is another Democratic gubernatorial debate. It's set for tonight. It's going to take place from the Miramar Cultural Center in Broward County. It's sponsored by the Service Employees International Union, the Dream Defenders Action Fund, the Florida Immigrant Coalition, New Florida Majority, Organized Florida, Florida Planned Parenthood, and Color of Change PAC. And there are debate watch parties all over the state. There's going to be a debate watch party tonight at 5:30 at the West Tampa Library from 5:30 to 9 o'clock. This is a two-hour debate that the candidates will take part in tonight. Not sure which TV station it's on, but it'll be available, I'm sure, on it'll be available, I'm sure, on some TV channel. The candidates, the Democratic candidates, doing two major debates. The one Saturday night here in Tampa that was held in Pinellas Park at the Pinellas Park High School, and the debate tonight in Broward County, too. Working hard doing those debates. Well, if you saw the debate on Saturday night, if you've got comments about your favorite candidate, you can also call us up at 813-239-9663. Adam writes this regarding the current race for U.S. Senate. Adam writes, Rick Scott took the Fifth Amendment 75 times when he was in court dealing with the huge Medicare fraud his company committed. As our dear leader Donald Trump says, if you take the Fifth, you must be guilty. I don't understand how any senior citizens would trust Rick Scott. Adam suggests voting for Bill, meaning Bill Nelson. But if you've got other thoughts, you're welcome to email us. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. There was an interesting, we're going to open up the phone lines in just a moment. There was an interesting story that was on the McClatchy newspaper site, and it came up this morning. The headline is, Web of Elite Russians Met with NRA Execs During the 2016 Campaign. So this idea that somehow the NRA was involved in channeling Russian money, it gets more credence with this story. And I'll just read the first four or five paragraphs. The story in McClatchy from the McClatchy News Service says this: several prominent Russians, some in President Vladimir Putin's inner circle or high in the Russian Orthodox Church, now have been identified as having contact with the National Rifle Association during the 2016 U.S. election campaign. The contacts have emerged amid a deepening Justice Department investigation into whether Russian banker and lifetime NRA member Alexander Torshin illegally channeled money through the gun rights group to add financial firepower to Donald Trump's 2016 presidential bid. The article goes on to say other influential Russians who met with NRA representatives during the campaign include Dmitry Rogozin, who until last month served as a deputy prime minister overseeing Russia's defense industry, and Sergei Rudov, head of one of Russia's largest philanthropies, the St. Basil the Great Charitable Foundation. The foundation was launched by an ultra-nationalist ally of Russian President Putin. The McClatchy story this morning goes on to say, the Russians talked and dined with NRA representatives, mainly in Moscow, as U.S. presidential candidates vied for the White House. Now U.S. investigators want to know if relationships between the Russian leaders and the nation's largest gun rights group went beyond vodka toasts and gun factory tours, evolving into another facet of the Kremlin's broad election interference operation. Even as the contacts took place, Kremlin cyber operatives were secretly hacking top Democrats' emails and barraging American social media accounts with fake news stories aimed at damaging the image of Democratic presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton and boosting the prospects of Republican Donald Trump. It is a crime potentially punishable with prison time to donate or use foreign money in U.S. elections campaigns. So that's a story on the McClatchy News website this morning. Brand new news, headlined, Web of Elite Russians Met with NRA Execs During the 2016 Campaign. So there is an investigation into whether the NRA somehow funneled Russian money into the Trump campaign. We'll see where that goes. 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. And Jeff in Newport Richey says, much like Hillary Clinton, he says, Governor Rick Scott has never been convicted of any crime. Given his penchant for sanctuary cities and protecting illegal aliens, Bill Nelson is not a good choice. I suggest voting for Rick Scott, writes Jeff in Newport Richey, who is saying that Rick Scott has never been convicted of any crime. Therefore, he deserves your vote. What do you think? 813-239-9663. And there was that big controversy over the weekend involving the G7 summit meeting in Quebec. And U.S. response to the Canadian prime minister has been very harsh. If you watched the TV news shows yesterday morning, you saw all sorts of attacks from President Trump's spokespeople against Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Let's listen. We'll listen into a little bit of what Trudeau said. But before we do that, reading from the New York Times this morning, the Times reports that the ink had barely dried on the communique after the G7 summit meeting in Charlevoix, Quebec, when President Trump berated Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Twitter from Air Force One, accusing Trudeau of being very dishonest and weak and of making up false statements. Trump wrote, based on Justin's false statements at his news conference and the fact that Canada is charging massive tariffs to our U.S. farmers, workers, and companies, I've instructed our U.S. representatives not to endorse the communique as we look at tariffs on automobiles that are flooding the U.S. market. As Canadians were recovering from the sting of those remarks, Trump's economic advisor Larry Kudlow piled on, saying on television yesterday morning that Trudeau had stabbed us in the back, betrayed Mr. Trump, and made him look weak before his summit meeting on Tuesday with North Korea's leader. And Peter Navarro, the president's top trade advisor, suggested on Fox News Sunday yesterday that there is a special place in hell for Trudeau. Mr. Trump's ire appears to have been spurred after Mr. Trudeau said Canada would retaliate against U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum products, calling them kind of insulting and saying the Canadians are nice, but we will not be pushed around. All right, so let's listen back to the remarks that sparked this stinging response from President Trump, from Larry Kudlow, and from Peter Navarro. Trump said these remarks are false statements. Kudlow said that this is stabbing us in the back, meaning the U.S., and Navarro says there's a special place in hell for Prime Minister Trudeau for making these remarks. Well, what could Trudeau have said that was so controversial? Well, let's listen in. Let's listen to Trudeau himself speaking after the G7 summit meeting at a press conference. This is what ticked off President Trump and his administration.
Did directly to the president that Canadians did not take it lightly, that the United States has moved forward with significant tariffs on our steel and aluminum industry, particularly did not take lightly the fact that it's based on a national security reason that for Canadians who either themselves or whose parents or community members have stood shoulder to shoulder with American soldiers in far-off lands and conflicts from the First World War onwards, that it's kind of insulting. And I highlighted that it was not helping in our renegotiation of NAFTA, and that it would be with regret, but it would be with absolute certainty and firmness that we move forward with retaliatory measures on July 1st, applying equivalent tariffs to the ones that the Americans have unjustly applied to us.
Well, that's Prime Minister Trudeau saying that they're going to move forward with their response to the tariffs that President Trump put on Canadian goods just a few days ago, saying what he would do. So it looks like we're in a trade war, but the U.S. response to those remarks, President Trump called Prime Minister Trudeau's remarks false statements. And then Larry Kudlow says Canada's stabbing us in the back with those remarks. And Peter Navarro, the president's top trade advisor, suggested on Fox yesterday that there's a special place in hell for Trudeau because of those remarks. So what do you think? Do you think those remarks were intemperate? Do you think that they're consistent or inconsistent with what Canada has said all along? What do you think? 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. So let's talk about some of these news items that we brought up since 11 o'clock. M writes, Republican is a bozo. Okay. M says, I can't believe that he blamed Puerto Rico for not preparing for Hurricane Maria after Andrew. That was the Republican on the TV show. And M goes on to say, Andrew occurred in 1993. Clearly, your Republican guest doesn't realize that Puerto Rico is a colony that the states took after the War of 1812. Puerto Rico doesn't have the same autonomy as a state, writes M. So, M, thank you for that email. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Tony writes this, 600,000 Canadians winter in Florida. Don't we owe them an apology from their Florida friends and neighbors? Trudeau is 1,000 times the human being that Trump is. Call Governor Scott as I did and ask that he apologize on behalf of most Floridians. That's Tony in St. Petersburg. And let's go to the phones. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And let's talk about some of these items in the news. And Teresa's in St. Pete. Hi, Teresa. What's on your mind today?
Oh, I think Prime Minister Trudeau is right on. If we're going to stab our allies in the back, I think they have the right to do it to us, too.
Yeah, I think it's a question of who launched the first shot. It looks like
President Trump
launched the first shot, right?
He doesn't, I don't know. I think him and the whole Republican Party just doesn't seem to care. They're not doing anything in Congress. And people that vote for him think he's doing great. It's wonderful, marvelous, whatever those great words they talk about. And, you know, I hate to say all Republicans, but the ones that voted for him, you know, I don't get it. That he's just a horrible human being, and I think there's a special place in hell for him. But, you know, that's just... But all of them are right on it, and they should throw us out of the G7 and become the G6. I think they should. They should all retaliate against us. I'm for that. I mean, he's a terrible person. He is destroying our country, and the Republicans in Congress are letting him.
So, Teresa, the U.S. has always had a good relationship with Canada. Is
not anymore.
Over the last 60 years or so, I've been up to Canada and had a great time more than a dozen times.
I think they're wonderful people.
Why do you think the president is picking this fight with Canada and trying to disrupt the relationship?
I think Putin influences him a lot, and Putin's always wanted us away from the European unions and stuff like that. So he's for the dictators because he wants to be a dictator. And our Congress, our Republican Congress, the Republican Party is allowing him to do this. They can stop him easy enough, but they won't. Because they want to be the party that's going to be, they want a one-party system. They don't want us Democrats being able to vote, because as you see what they're doing around the country to suppress Democrats' right to vote, this to me, that's what it seems like. I've never been a conspiracy theorist person, but all this stuff just seems to be right in our faces. And they seem to be doing it. In Ohio, I think they just struck down that if you don't vote in a couple of elections, you can be purged from the registration. And now you have to go and do this. And this usually disenfranchises low income and minorities, and that's what they want. And there's not enough. Evidently, there's not enough of us. I hate to say white, but enough of us white Democrats to get out and vote so we can make sure that people aren't being disenfranchised. That
All
we
right.
need to step up and go, look, you cannot do this to our other American citizens just because they're Hispanic or black. You can't do that. And we have to stand up with them and, you know, do it. Rather you want to like a Democrat candidate or not, I was listening to The View last week, and I think Eric Dyson, I think his name is Michael Eric Dyson, he said, look, you're not going to date the people. Just go with, you know, you're not going to form a girlfriend-boyfriend relationship with these people. He was talking about Hillary. You're not going to want her to be your girlfriend. You have to go with the issues, and he was talking about that, and I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I don't want to date any of these people, or it's just the issues, what's important in this country. And I think human rights and our civil rights as American citizens is more important than anything. But I guess Republicans, at least the ones that voted for Trump, I'm not going to throw the whole party under the bus, but at least the ones that voted for Trump, a lot of those are racist, and the ones that say they aren't, they're okay with him being that way.
All right, Teresa, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. All right, good to hear from you. Well, if you want to disagree or agree with anything you've heard here, you're welcome to call. Here's the number, 813-239-9663. And let's go to Bob, who's in Town and Country. Bob, you're on. What would you like to say?
Oh, yeah. Oh, great to hear that right before I talk. You know, someone will call up after and say I'm brainwashed and all that. I've been researching and following politics pretty heavily for quite a while. You know, no one's disenfranchising. They assume that everybody that's poor, you know, is a Democrat or a liberal. And, you know, and over the years, you know, I have voted for Obama the first time. And I'll tell you, the things that are being accomplished, you know, whether it be, you know, I don't see Hillary. It would have been status quo with her at best. And, you know, job, you know, we didn't get any, you know, growth in wages. There's a lot more jobs. You know, there's a lot of things that are going in the right direction. As far as trade, we have been getting the short end of the stick, and he's being firm. And, you know, I voted for Trump, and, you know, I am not a racist. Matter of fact, I like to see what she does. I volunteer with homeless. I do all kind of things, and everybody thinks I'm a liberal because I do these things. And you know, and I this country needs to be fixed. You know, you're not dating.
Hey, Bob,
Trump
let me.
Either.
Bob, let me
well,
ask
you're
you.
Not dating Donald Trump.
Well, let me finish. Well, no, I don't want. I'm not gonna argue with you. I'm just curious. You voted for Obama in 2008. Is that when you voted for him?
Yeah, the first time.
Did you vote for him the second time?
No.
Yeah, and then you voted for Trump in 2016. And what was it that?
Yes.
Okay, so what was it that Trump said that made you want to vote for him?
I've tried to explain this to people is why I call so that you do get both. You know, they've got every Trump voter is a racist, and that is not true because I talk to people, even Democrats that I know and liberals, they're tired of hearing half of this stuff. You know, focusing on things that aren't. This country has, you know, he has accomplished a lot of things. Whether you agree with his message, that's all.
I'm just curious as to why you. I'm just curious about why you voted for him.
I liked how he spoke on the issues and the things that I had been looking at over the years that I've seen, you know, like with trade and all that. And he seemed to be a person because of his ego. You know, I don't look at it as a bad. I said because of his ego, he will actually try to get things done instead of folding at the first sign. All right, well, I guess that's politics. And, you know, I didn't think he'd win because the media was hammering him and he wasn't the darling like Hillary. But as you know, I was going to go with Cruz, but I thought, man, I don't think he has the backbone to do this. And, you know, as it got closer and I heard, you know, it wasn't the rah-rah, you know, where everybody build the wall, you know, and I agree. We don't, immigration needs to be fixed, but you know, in my opinion, we don't need people sneaking over. You know, a lot of bad things happen to these people. You know, I do care, and I think that they should be taken care of, but not at the, you want to talk about suppression. Do they want all these people to vote the Democrats? You know, I mean, there's a lot more sides to immigration than just allowing,
all right. Bob, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on the show. Bob, thanks a lot.
Jobs.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on the show. Great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Tony writes this, 600,000 Canadians winter in Florida. Don't we owe them an apology from their Florida friends and neighbors? I guess I just read that. Okay, sorry that Tony got that twice. Peter writes this, as CEO of Columbia HCA, Rick Scott oversaw the largest Medicare fraud in American history and barely avoided prison. That's Pete in Tampa, who's not going to vote for Rick Scott for U.S. Senate. Dennis writes this, trade war GOP comments. He says such comments only serve the interests of the Kremlin. They certainly aren't American patriots. You know, there were some people that complained that President Obama took too much power for himself when he was president. Now President Trump is imposing these tariffs. Is that taking too much power? And what impact do you think the tariffs are going to have on Canadian tourism in the coming season? How many months are we away? We're about 5 or 6 months away from the start of the new tourist season. Are these comments that are coming out of Washington and President Trump's administration going to hurt Canadian tourism here in Central and South Florida? What do you think? 813-239-9663. Mary writes this, Trump's remarks are ridiculous. Trudeau is a man of character and a true leader. He has every right to retaliate. Trump wants to give it and throws a tantrum when his bullying doesn't work. Trump is destroying this country, writes Mary. Let's go to Bill in Homosassa. Hi, Bill, you're on. What would you like to say?
I would like to say, what happened to United We Stand, Divided We Fall? This guy is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. I'm telling you, the ones that stand up, the guy you just had on here rattled on and on and on. The problem I got with Trump, he don't know what he's doing. I mean, you can sing a song, but delivering is a whole nother animal, and this guy is like a buffoon. I never, and the Republican Party, why are they putting up with this, Rob? What in God's name? I mean, he has no moral values, no ethics, with nothing. They're putting these kids in concentration camps and cages. My word.
You know, I think a lot of Republicans look at that just under 4% unemployment rate and say that's a good thing. And so that they're cheering on President Trump, and they're not looking at the, you know, the kids in cages. I don't think they're looking at the way that the president is disrupting relationships with some of our closest allies by taking, you know, this kind of power into his own hands without any sort of discussion with people in Congress or maybe people in industries that might be affected. I think they're just cheering him. I think there are some people that like to have a strong man in power. I think that's what Bob was getting at, that there is a certain number of people in this country that want a strong man. They want a guy that's going to take as much power into his hands as he can and use it in a way that they like.
They are overlooking the jobs you just mentioned. Minimum wage is, I don't even know, $7.50?
No, it's about just a little over $8 an hour, but it certainly doesn't cover the cost of housing. If you're getting paid minimum wage, and it's a good point, it does not cover the cost of housing. And millions of people, especially women, are paid minimum wage in this country.
And my son just took a job at $15 an hour, and it's a struggle for him to make a car payment. Lord knows if he didn't live with me, he couldn't afford housing whatsoever. Too proud to take any assistance, and they're chiseling away at the assistance.
Yeah, I think the fact that wages are still low and are not coming up, that's a huge problem. And I think that's part of, my guess is that's why Bob voted for President Trump, is that he wanted to see wages go up. He thought, okay, and no other president has brought wages up, so maybe he'll throw in his weight behind Trump. Bill, thanks a lot.
They're not happening. Okay,
Bill, thanks a lot. Well, it is a big, I think wages are the single biggest issue in our country. I that's what I think. 727 writes, your listener M is incorrect. Please inform listeners that the Spanish-American War in 1898 and not the War of 1812 is the source of U.S. control over Puerto Rico. James writes this, I believe we're living in a special place in hell since Trump was sworn in. And in 2018 and 2020, we need to get new blood in power, writes James. And let's go to Caitlin, who's driving. Caitlin, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi. So it's interesting hearing the back and forth about Trump. I wasn't a fan. I'm still not a fan. But most of the people in my family are. The people that are older than me were fans. And it always brings to mind the phrasing, which I'm going to totally butcher, something to the effect of, if you're not a liberal when you're young, you're heartless. And if you're not a Republican when you're old, you're brainless.
Yeah, that's a paraphrase of a Winston Churchill quote, I believe. Yep.
There you go. And I've been told that for a long time. And it's ironic because I'm more conservative than most of my peers, but I'm not, you know, I wouldn't put myself in the lump of hyper-conservative. And as my family's gotten older, they have become much more conservative. And so they're always trying to convince me why Trump is going to be a great president. And I just don't see it. I can't make that connection. And usually the line is, well, he's a businessman. He's a businessman. He's a successful businessman. He's a multimillionaire. He can run a country. But hasn't he, like, had to declare bankruptcy, and hasn't he had a bunch of businesses fail?
He has. He has declared bankruptcy five or six times, yeah.
You know, like, he may be a businessman, but is he the best kind of businessman that we need for a country?
Yeah, and don't you want to see his taxes? I mean, if he is a successful businessman and he makes money every year, let's see his taxes.
Right, and you know what? If we're talking about wages, let's talk about wages. You know, I work in a male-dominated field. I've had to fight to make sure that I get paid just the same as people that do the same job. You know, why, you know, look at my taxes. I'll offer them up on a platter. Look at my taxes in comparison to a peer of the opposite gender, and let's see where that pans out. Why can't we just get that to match?
Yeah.
You know?
Caitlin, we're out of time. Caitlin, thanks a lot.
Anyways, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, too. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on the comment line, 813-238-8001, extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned because Sean Canaan has a really interesting program, an interview with Roseanne Barr back when she was an Uber super liberal. Whoa, when was that? Okay, we're going to hear this interview that Sean did 2 years ago. It's an incredible interview, so stay tuned.